Chapter 15. How to Outwit the Six Ghosts of Fear. Take inventory of yourself as you read this closing chapter and find out how many of the ghosts are standing in your way. Before you can put any portion of this philosophy into successful use, your mind must be prepared to receive it. The preparation is not difficult. It begins with study, analysis, and the understanding of the three enemies which you shall have to clear out. These are indecision, doubt, and fear. The sixth sense will never function with these three negatives, or any of them remain in your mind. The members of this unholy trio are closely related. Where one is found, the other two are close at hand. Indecision is the seedling of fear. Remember this as you read. Indecision crystallizes into doubt. The two blend and become fear. The blending process is often slow. This is one reason why these three enemies are so dangerous. They germinate and grow without their presence being observed. The remainder of this chapter describes an end which must be attained before the philosophy, as a whole, can be put into practical use. It also analyzes a condition which has, but lately, reduced huge numbers of people to poverty, and it states a truth which must be understood by all who accumulate riches, whether measured in terms of money or a state of mind of far greater value than money. The purpose of this chapter is to turn the spotlight of attention upon the cause and the cure of the six basic fears. Before we can master an enemy, we must know its name, its habits, and its place of abode. As you read, analyze yourself carefully and determine which, if any, of the six common fears have attached themselves to you. Do not be deceived by the habits of these subtle enemies. Sometimes, they remain hidden in the subconscious mind, where they are difficult to locate and still more difficult to eliminate. The six basic fears. There are six basic fears, with some combination of which every human suffers at one time or another. Most people are fortunate if they do not suffer from the entire six. Named in the order of their most common appearance, they are the fear of poverty, the fear of criticism, the fear of ill health, the fear of loss of love of someone, the fear of old age, the fear of death. All other fears are of minor importance. They can be grouped under these six headings. The prevalence of these fears as a curse to the world runs in cycles. For almost 6 years, while the Depression was on, we floundered in the cycle of the fear of poverty. During the World War, we were in the cycle of fear of death. Just following the war, we were in the cycle of fear of ill health, as evidenced by the epidemic of disease which spread itself all over the world. Fears are nothing more than states of mind. One state of mind is subject to control and direction. Physicians, as everyone knows, are less subject to attack by disease than ordinary laymen, for the reason that physicians do not fear disease. Physicians, without fear or hesitation, have been known to physically contact hundreds of people daily who were suffering from such contagious diseases as smallpox without becoming infected. Their immunity against the disease consisted largely, if not solely, in their absolute lack of fear. Man can create nothing which he does not first conceive in the form of an impulse of thought. Following this statement comes another still greater importance, namely, man's thought impulses begin immediately to translate themselves into their physical equivalent, whether those thoughts are voluntary or involuntary. Thought impulses which are picked up through the ether by mere chance, thoughts which have been released by other minds, may determine one's financial, business, professional, or social destiny, just as surely as do the thought impulses which one creates by intent and design. We are here laying the foundation for the presentation of a fact of great importance to the person who does not understand why some people appear to be lucky, while others of equal or greater ability, training, experience, and brain capacity seem destined to ride with misfortune. This fact may be explained by the statement that every human being has the ability to completely control his own mind, and with this control, obviously every person may open his mind to the tramp thought impulses which are being released by other brains, or close the doors tightly and admit only thought impulses of his own choice. Nature has endowed man with absolute control over but one thing, and that is thought. This fact, coupled with the additional fact that everything which man creates begins in the form of a thought, leads one very near to the principle by which fear may be mastered. If it is true that all thought has a tendency to clothe itself in its physical equivalent, and this is true beyond any reasonable room for doubt, it is equally true that the thought impulses of fear and poverty cannot be translated into terms of courage and financial gain. The people of America begin to think of poverty following the Wall Street crash of 1929. Slowly but surely, the mass thought was crystallized into its physical equivalent, which was known as a depression. This had to happen in its conformity with the laws of nature. The fear of poverty. There can be no compromise between poverty and riches. The two roads that lead to poverty and riches travel in opposite directions. If you want riches, you must refuse to accept any circumstance that leads towards poverty. The word riches is used in its broadest sense, meaning financial, spiritual, mental, and material estates. The starting point of the path that leads to riches is desire. In Chapter 1, you received full instructions for the proper use of desire. In this chapter on fear, you have complete instructions for preparing your mind to make practical use of desire. Here, then, is the place to give yourself a challenge, which will definitely determine how much of this philosophy you have absorbed. Here is the point at which you can turn profit and foretell, accurately, what the future holds in store for you. If after reading this chapter, you are willing to accept poverty, you may as well make up your mind to receive poverty. This is one decision you cannot avoid. If you demand riches, determine what form and how much will require to satisfy you. You know the road that leads to riches. You have been given a roadmap which, if followed, will keep you on that road. If you neglect to make the start or stop before you arrive, no one will be to blame but you. The responsibility is yours. No alibi will save you from accepting the responsibility if you now fail or refuse to demand riches of life, because the acceptance calls for but one thing, incidentally, the only thing you can control, and that is a state of mind. A state of mind is something that one assumes. It cannot be purchased, it must be created. Fear of poverty is a state of mind, nothing else. But it is sufficient to destroy one's chances of achievement in any undertaking, a truth which became painfully evident during the Depression. This fear paralyzes the faculty of reason, destroys the faculty of imagination, kills off self-reliance, undermines enthusiasm, discourages initiative, leads to uncertainty of purpose, encourages procrastination, wipes out enthusiasm, and makes self-control an impossibility. It takes the charm from one's personality, destroys the possibility of accurate thinking, diverts concentration of effort, it masters persistence, turns the willpower into nothingness, destroys ambition, beclouds the memory, and invites failure in every conceivable form. It kills love and assassinates the finer emotions of the heart, discourages friendship and invites disaster in 100 forms, leads to sleeplessness, misery, and unhappiness. All of this despite the obvious truth that we live in a world of overabundance of everything the heart could desire, with nothing standing between us and our desires, excepting lack of a definite purpose. The fear of poverty is without a doubt the most destructive of the 6 basic fears. It has been placed at the head of the list because it is the most difficult to master. Considerable courage is required to state the truth about the origin of this fear, and still greater courage to accept the truth after it has been stated. The fear of poverty grew out of a man's inherent tendency to prey upon his fellow man economically. Nearly all animals lower than man are motivated by instinct, but their capacity to think is limited. Therefore, they prey upon one another physically. Man, with a superior sense of intuition, with the capacity to think and reason, does not eat his fellow man bodily. He gets more satisfaction out of eating him financially. Man is so avaricious that every conceivable law has been passed to safeguard him from his fellow man. Of all the ages of the world, of which we know anything, the age in which we live seems to be one that is outstanding because of man's money madness. A man is considered less than dust unless he can display a fat bank account, but if he has money, never mind how he acquired it, he is a king or a big shot, he is above the law, he rules in politics, he dominates in business, and the whole world about him bows in respect when he passes. Nothing brings man so much suffering and humility as poverty. Only those who have experienced poverty understand the full meaning of this. It is no wonder that man fears poverty. Through a long line of inherited experiences, man has learned for sure that some men cannot be trusted where monies of matter and earthly possessions are concerned. This is a rather stinging indictment, the worst part of it being that it is true. The majority of marriages are motivated by the wealth possessed by one or both of the contracting parties. It is no wonder, therefore, that divorce courts are busy. So eager is man to possess wealth that he will acquire it in whatever manner he can, through legal methods if possible, through other methods if necessary or expedient. Self-analysis may disclose weakness which one does not like to acknowledge. This form of examination is essential to all who demand of life more than mediocrity and poverty. Remember as you check yourself point by point that you are both the court and the jury, the prosecuting attorney and the attorney for the defense, and that you are the plaintiff and a defendant also, that you are on trial. Face the facts squarely. Ask yourself definite questions and demand direct replies. When the examination is over, you will know more about yourself. If you do not feel that you can be an impartial judge in this self-examination, call upon someone who knows you very well to serve as a judge while you cross-examine yourself. You are after the truth. Get it, no matter at what cost, even though it may temporarily embarrass you. The majority of people, if asked what they fear most, would reply, "I fear nothing." The reply would be inaccurate because few people realize that they are bound, handicapped, whipped spiritually and physically through some form of fear. So subtle and deeply seated is the emotion of fear that one may go through life burdened with it, never recognizing its presence. Only a courageous analysis will disclose the presence of this universal enemy. When you begin such an analysis, search deeply into your character. Here is a list of the symptoms for which you should look. Symptoms of the fear of poverty. Indifference, commonly expressed through lack of ambition, willingness to tolerate poverty. Acceptance of whatever compensation life may offer without protest, mental and physical laziness, lack of initiative, imagination, enthusiasm, and self-control. Indecision, the habit of permitting others to do one's thinking, staying on the fence. Doubt, generally expressed through alibis and excuses designed to cover up, explain away, or apologize for one's failures, sometimes expressed in a form of envy of those who are successful or by criticizing them. Worry, usually expressed by finding fault with others, a tendency to spend beyond one's income, neglect of personal appearance, scowling and frowning. Intemperance and the use of alcoholic drink, sometimes through the use of narcotics, nervousness, lack of poise, self-consciousness, and lack of self-reliance. Overcaution, the habit of looking for the negative side of every circumstance, thinking and talking of possible failure instead of concentrating upon the means of succeeding, knowing all the roads to disaster, but never searching for plans to avoid failure, waiting for the right time to begin putting ideas and plans into action until the waiting becomes a permanent habit, remembering those who have failed and forgetting those who have succeeded, seeing the hole in the donut but overlooking the donut, pessimism leading to indigestion, poor elimination, auto-intoxication, bad breath, and bad disposition, procrastination, the habit of putting off tomorrow that which should have been done last year, spending enough time and creating alibis and excuses to have the job done. The symptom is closely related to overcaution, doubt, and worry. Refusal to accept responsibility when it can be avoided. Willingness to compromise rather than to put up a stiff fight. Compromising with difficulties instead of harnessing and using them as stepping stones to advancement. Bargaining with life for a penny instead of demanding prosperity, opulence, riches, contentment, and happiness. Planning what to do if and when overtaken by failure instead of burning all bridges and making retreat impossible. Weakness of and often total lack of self-confidence, definite of purpose, self-control, initiative, enthusiasm, ambition, thrift, and sound reasoning ability. Expecting poverty instead of demanding riches. Association with those who accept poverty instead of seeking the companies of those who demand and receive riches. Money talks. Someone will ask, "Why did you write a book about money? Why measure riches in dollars alone?" Some will believe, and rightly so, that there are other forms of riches more desirable than money. Yes, there are riches which cannot be measured in terms of dollars, but there are millions of people who will say, "Give me all the money I need and I will find everything else I want." The major reason why I wrote this book on how to get money is the fact that the world has but lately passed through an experience that left millions of men and women paralyzed with the fear of poverty. What this sort of fear does to one was well described by Westbrook Pegler in the New York World Telegram. Money is only clamshells or metal discs or scraps of paper, and there are treasures of the heart and soul which money cannot buy, but most people, being broke, are unable to keep this in mind and sustain their spirits. When a man is down and out on the street, unable to get a job at all, something happens to his spirit which can be observed in the droop of his shoulders, the set of his hat, his walk, and his gaze. He cannot escape a feeling of inferiority among people with regular employment, even though he knows they are definitely not his equals in character, intelligence, or ability. These people, even his friends, feel on the other hand a sense of superiority and regard him perhaps unconsciously as a casualty. He may borrow for a time, but not enough to carry on in his accustomed way, and he cannot continue to borrow very long. But borrowing in itself, when a man is borrowing merely to live, is a depressing experience, and the money lacks the power of earned money to revive his spirits. Of course, none of this applies to the bums or habitual ne'er-do-wells, but only to men of normal ambitions and self-respect. Women conceal despair. Women in the same predicament must be different. We somehow do not think of women at all in considering the down and outers. They are scarce in the breadlines, they rarely are seen begging on the streets, and they are not recognizable in the crowds by the same plain signs which identified busted men. Of course, I do not mean the shuffling hags of the city streets, who are the opposite number of the confirmed male bums. I mean reasonably young, decent, and intelligent women. There must be many of them, but their despair is not apparent. Maybe they kill themselves. When a man is down and out, he has time on his hands for brooding. He may travel miles to see a man about a job and discover that the job is filled, or that it is one of those jobs with no base pay, but only a commission on the sale of some useless knick-knack which nobody would buy except out of pity. Turning that down, he finds himself back on the street with nowhere to go but just anywhere. So he walks and walks. He gazes into store windows at luxuries which are not for him, and feels inferior and gives way to people who stop and look with an active interest. He wanders into the railroad station or puts himself down in the library to ease his legs and soak up a little heat, but that isn't looking for a job, so he gets going again. He may not know it, but his aimlessness would give him away even if the lines of his figure did not. He may be well dressed in the clothes left over from the days when he had a steady job, but the clothes cannot disguise the droop. Money makes the difference. He sees thousands of other people, bookkeepers or clerks or chemists or wagon hands, busy at their work and envies them from the bottom of his soul. They have their independence, their self-respect, and manhood, and he simply cannot convince himself that he is a good man too, though he argue it out and arrive at a favorable verdict hour after hour. It is just money which makes this difference in him. With a little money, he would be himself again. Some employers take the most shocking advantage of people who are down and out. The agencies hang out little colored cards, offering miserable wages to busted men, $12 a week, $15 a week. An $18 a week job is a plum, and anyone with $25 a week to offer does not hang the job in front of an agency on a colored card. I have a want ad clip from a local paper demanding a clerk, a good clean penman, to take telephone orders for a sandwich shop from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for $8 a month. Not $8 a week, but $8 a month. The ad also says, state religion. Can you imagine the brutal effrontery of anyone who demands a good, clean penman for 11 cents an hour inquiring into the victim's religion? But that is what busted people are offered. The fear of criticism. Just how man originally came by this fear, no one can state definitely, but one thing is certain. He has it in a highly developed form. Some believe that this fear made its appearance about the time that politics became a profession. Others believe it can be traced to the age when women first began to concern themselves with styles and wearing apparel. This author, being neither a humorist nor a prophet, is inclined to attribute the basic fear of criticism to that part of man's inherited nature, which prompts him not only to take away his fellow men's goods and wares, but to justify his action by criticism of his fellow men's character. It is a well-known fact that a thief will criticize the man from whom he steals, that politicians seek office not by displaying their own virtues and qualification, but by attempting to besmirch their opponents. The fear of criticism takes on many forms, the majority of which are petty and trivial. Bald-headed men, for example, are bald for no other reason than their fear of criticism. Heads become bald because of the tight-fitting bands of the hats which cut off the circulation from the roots of the hair. Men wear hats not because they actually need them, but mainly because everyone is doing it. The individual falls in line and does likewise, lest some other individual criticize him. Women seldom have bald heads, or even thin hair, because they wear hats which fit their heads loosely, the only purpose of the hats being adornment. But it must not be supposed that women are free from the fear of criticism. If any woman claims to be superior to man with reference to this fear, ask her to walk down the street wearing a hat of the vintage of 1890. The astute manufacturers of clothing have not been slow to capitalize this basic fear of criticism with which all mankind has been cursed. Every season, the styles in many articles of wearing apparel change. Who establishes the styles? Certainly not the purchaser of clothing, but the manufacturer. Why does he change the style so often? The answer is obvious. He changes the styles so he can sell more clothes. For the same reason the manufacturers of automobiles, with a few and very sensible exceptions, change styles of models every season. No man wants to drive an automobile which is not of the latest style, although the older model may actually be a better car. We have been describing the manner in which people behave under the influence of fear of criticism as applied to the small and petty things of life. Let us now examine human behavior when this fear affects people in connection with the more important events of human relationship. Take, for example, practically any person who has reached the age of mental maturity, from 35 to 40 years of age as a general average, and if you could read the secret thoughts of his mind, you would find a very decided disbelief in most of the fables taught by the majority of the dogmatists and the theologians a few decades back. Not often, however, will you find a person who has the courage to openly state his belief on this subject. Most people will, if pressed far enough, tell a lie rather than admit that they do not believe the stories associated with the form of religion which held people in bondage prior to the age of scientific discovery and education. Why does the average person, even in this day of enlightenment, shy away from denying his belief in the fables, which were the basis of most of the religions a few decades back? The answer is because of the fear of criticism. Men and women have been burned at the stake for daring to express disbelief in ghosts. It is no wonder we have inherited a consciousness which makes us fear criticism. The time was, and not far in the past, when criticism carried severe punishments. It still does in some countries. The fear of criticism robs a man of his initiative, destroys his power of imagination, limits his individuality, takes away his self-reliance, and does him damage in 100 other ways. Parents often do their children irreparable injury by criticizing them. The mother of one of my boyhood chums used to punish him with a switch almost daily, always completing the job with the statement, "You'll land in the penitentiary before you are 20. He was sent to a reformatory at the age of 17. Criticism is the one form of service of which everyone has too much. Everyone has a stock of it which is handed out gratis, whether called for or not. One's nearest relatives are often the worst offenders. It should be recognized as a crime, in reality it is a crime of the worst nature, for any parent to build inferiority complexes in the mind of a child through unnecessary criticism. Employers who understand human nature get the best there is in men not by criticism but by constructive suggestion. Parents may accomplish the same results with their children. Criticism will plant fear in the human heart or resentment, but it will not build love or affection. Symptoms of the fear of criticism. This fear is almost as universal as the fear of poverty, and its effects are just as fatal to personal achievement, mainly because this destroys the initiative and discourages the use of imagination. The major symptoms of fear are self-consciousness, generally expressed through nervousness, timidity in conversation, and in meeting strangers, awkward movement of the hands and limbs, shifting of the eyes. Lack of poise, expressed through the lack of voice control, nervousness in the presence of others, poor posture of the body, poor memory. Personality, lacking in firmness of decision, personal charm, and ability to express opinions definitely. The habit of sidestepping issues instead of meeting them squarely. Agreeing with others without careful examination of their opinions. Inferiority complex. The habit of expressing self-approval by word of mouth and by actions as a means of covering up a feeling of inferiority. Using big words to impress others, often without knowing the real meaning of words. Imitating others in dress, speech, and manners. Boasting of imaginary achievements. This sometimes gives a surface appearance of a feeling of superiority. Extravagance. The habit of trying to keep up with the Joneses, spending beyond one's income. Lack of initiative. Failure to embrace opportunities for self-advancement. Fear to express opinions. Lack of confidence in one's own ideas. Giving evasive answers to questions asked by superiors. Hesitancy of manner and speech. deceit in both words and deeds. Lack of ambition, mental and physical laziness, lack of self-assertion, slowness in reaching decisions, easily influenced by others, the habit of criticizing others behind their backs and flattering them to their faces, the habit of accepting defeat without protest, quitting an undertaking when opposed by others, suspicious of other people without cause, lacking in tactfulness of manner and speech, unwillingness to accept the blame for mistakes. The fear of ill health. This fear may be traced to both physical and social heredity. It is closely associated as to its origin with the causes of fear of old age and the fear of death because it leads one closely to the border of the terrible worlds of which man knows not, but concerning which he has been taught some discomforting stories. The opinion is somewhat general also that certain unethical people engaged in the business of selling health have had not a little to do with keeping alive the fear of ill health. In the main, man fears ill health because of the terrible pictures which have been planted in his mind of what may happen if death should overtake him. He also fears it because of the economic toll which it may claim. A reputable physician estimated that 75% of all people who visit physicians for professional service are suffering with hypochondria, imaginary illness. It has been shown most convincingly that fear of disease, even when there is not the slightest cause for fear, often produces the physical symptoms of the disease feared. Powerful and mighty is the human mind. It builds or it destroys. Playing upon this common weakness of fear of ill health, dispensers of patent medicines have reaped fortunes. This form of imposition upon credulous humanity became so prevalent some 20 years ago that Collier's Weekly Magazine conducted a bitter campaign against one of the worst offenders in the patent medicine business. During the flu epidemic, which broke out during the World War, the mayor of New York City took drastic steps to check the damage which people were doing themselves through inherent fear of ill health. He called in the newspaper men and said to them, "Gentlemen, I feel it is necessary to ask you not to publish any scare headlines concerning the flu epidemic. Unless you cooperate with me, we will have a situation which we cannot control." The newspapers quit publishing stories about the flu, and within 1 month, the epidemic had been successfully checked. Through a series of experiments conducted some years ago, it was proved that people may be ill by suggestion. We conducted this experiment by causing three acquaintances to visit the victims, each of whom asked the question, "What ails you? You look terribly ill." The first questioner usually provoked a grin and a nonchalant, "Oh, nothing, I'm all right," from the victim. The second questioner usually was answered with the statement, "I don't know exactly, but I do feel badly." The third questioner was usually met with the frank admission that the victim was actually feeling ill. Try this on an acquaintance if you doubt that it will make him uncomfortable, but do not carry the experiment too far. There is a certain religious sect whose members take vengeance upon their enemies by the hexing method. They call it placing a spell on the victim. There is overwhelming evidence that disease sometimes begins in the form of negative thought impulse. Such an impulse may be passed from one mind to another by suggestion or created by an individual in his own mind. A man who was blessed with more wisdom than this incident might indicate once said, "When anyone asks me how I feel, I always want to answer by knocking him down." Doctors send patients into new climates for their health because a change of mental attitude is necessary. The seed of fear of ill health lives in every human mind. Worry, fear, discouragement, disappointment in love and business affairs caused the seed to germinate and grow. The recent business depression kept the doctors on the run because every form of negative thinking may cause ill health. Disappointments in business and in love stand at the head of the list of causes of fear of ill health. A young man suffered a disappointment in love, which sent him to a hospital. For months, he hovered between life and death. A specialist in suggestive therapeutics was called in. The specialist changed nurses, placing him in charge of a very charming young woman who began by prearrangement with the doctor to make love to him the first day of her arrival on the job. Within 3 weeks, the patient was discharged from the hospital, still suffering, but with an entire different malady. He was in love again. The remedy was a hoax, but the patient and the nurse were later married. Both are in good health at the time of this writing. Symptoms of the fear of ill health. The symptoms of this almost universal fear are autosuggestion, the habit of negative use of self-suggestion by looking for and expecting to find the symptoms of all kinds of disease, enjoying imaginary illness and speaking of it as being real, the habit of trying all fads and isms recommended by others as having therapeutic value, talking to others of operations, accidents, and other forms of illness, experimenting with diets, physical exercises, reducing systems without professional guidance, trying home remedies, patent medicines, and quack remedies. Hypochondria, the habit of talking of illness, concentrating the mind upon disease, and expecting its appearance until a nervous break occurs. Nothing that comes in bottles can cure this condition. It is brought on by negative thinking, and nothing but positive thought can effect a cure. Hypochondria, a medical term for imaginary disease, is said to do as much damage on occasion as a disease one fears might do. Most so-called cases of nerves come from imaginary illness. Exercise. Fear of ill health often interferes with proper physical exercise and results in overweight by causing one to avoid outdoor life. Susceptibility. Fear of ill health breaks down nature's body resistance and creates a favorable condition for any form of disease one may contact. The fear of ill health often is related to the fear of poverty, especially in the case of the hypochondriac who constantly worries about the possibility of having to pay doctor bills, hospital bills, etc. This type of person spends much time preparing for sickness, talking about death, saving money for cemetery plots and burial expenses, etc. Self-coddling, the habit of making a bid for sympathy using imaginary illness as the lure. People often resort to this trick to avoid work. The habit of feigning illness to cover plain laziness or to serve as an alibi for lack of ambition. Intemperance, the habit of using alcohol or narcotics to destroy pain such as headache, neuralgia, etc. instead of eliminating the cause. The habit of reading about illness and worrying over the possibility of being stricken by it. The habit of reading patent medicine advertisements. The fear of loss of love. The original source of this inherent fear needs but little description because it obviously grew out of a man's polygamous habit of stealing his fellow man's mate and his habit of taking liberties with her whenever he could. Jealousy and other similar forms of dementia praecox grow out of a man's inherited fear of the loss of love of someone. This fear is the most painful of all six of the basic fears. It probably plays more havoc with the body and mind than any of the other basic fears, as it often leads to permanent insanity. The fear of loss of love probably dates back to the Stone Age when men stole women by brute force. They continue to steal females, but their technique has changed. Instead of force, they now use persuasion, the promise of pretty clothes, motor cars, and other bait, much more effective than physical force. Man's habits are the same as they were at the dawn of civilization, but he expresses them differently. Careful analysis has shown that women are more susceptible to this fear than men. This fact is easily explained. Women have learned from experience that men are polygamous by nature and they are not to be trusted in the hands of rivals. Symptoms of the fear of loss of love. The distinguishing symptoms of this fear are jealousy. The habit of being suspicious of friends and loved ones without any reasonable evidence of sufficient grounds. Jealousy is a form of dementia praecox, which sometimes becomes violent without the slightest cause. The habit of accusing wife or husband of infidelity without grounds. General suspicion of everyone. Absolute faith in no one. Fault finding. The habit of fault finding with friends, relatives, business associates, and loved ones upon the slightest provocation or without any cause whatsoever. Gambling, the habit of gambling, stealing, cheating, and otherwise taking hazardous chances to provide money for loved ones with the belief that love can be bought. The habit of spending beyond one's means or incurring debts to provide gifts for loved ones with the object of making a favorable showing. Insomnia, nervousness, lack of persistence, weakness of will, lack of self-control, lack of self-reliance, bad temper.